to have a series of public lectures with high-profile people in which we get to engage the academic and non-academic community, get to meet and engage with these important people. We've also been developing a collection of otherwise hard-to-access legal biographies, which we have by way of a small private collection that we keep upstairs, which is open for scholars if they're interested in looking at them. And under the guidance of my friend and colleague Mara at the back, we've also been digitalising some of the hard-to-get Ivor Jennings papers, in particular what Mara characterises as the Oriental Jennings papers, some of the things for which not many scholars have necessarily accessed and worked with. So we're digitalising that, and that will be going on the project website quite soon. We've also been trying to extend our own research base. So we have two PhD students attached to the project, one of whom, Deborah, is here tonight, and she's been co-funded in her research, her PhD research, with the British Library. We have a collaborative doctoral award with the Oral Histories Projects. There we ran a joint conference with them last year on biographies of marginalised people, and that's coming out as a special issue of the Journal of Law and Society next year. So we're really trying to move into building up our research capacity as well. Okay, so tonight we're teaming up this event with the relaunch of the Women in London Law Schools network. People keep on asking me what's the agenda for the network. I really haven't got any further than it would be really nice just to get together and have a drink and start talking about what that agenda might be. So thanks very much to those of you who have come from other colleges within the University of London. Welcome, and I hope we can begin an important discussion tonight about that. Okay, Fiona, I'll hand over to you.
Thank you very much, Linda.
So, please ask me if I would talk about my Early Women Law Professors project. So, I thought I'd just fill you in on a little bit of background and tell you a little bit about what I've found out. Obviously, the object of the project is to analyse the lived experience of some of the early women law professors and put their experience into a social and historical context and think about what it might mean for us today. And that's the kind of serious bit. It began because in 2009 I was co-authoring the history of the Society of Legal Scholars, which was celebrating its centenary. And I opted to have, from 1960 onwards, that was my period, and my co-author was anything before 1960, which suited us both fine. And as I read about the 60s and 70s, I was noticing that there really weren't very many women mentioned. And I kind of kept looking for them, and I kept on digging my co-author and saying, can you just look out for women? You know, when you're doing all this research, can you just look out for women? And during the course of our research, we discovered that the first person to be appointed as a law professor, a female law professor in the UK, was Claire Pally. And Claire Pally was appointed at Queen's University Belfast in 1970. And that seemed amazingly late to me, because I went to university in 1973, and I didn't realise that at that time, in Bristol, where I was, in the law school — I wasn't in the law school, but in the law school — there were no women legal academics at all. And it just seemed, you know, this is my lifetime, how bizarre. Anyway, that's why I started researching. And so, essentially, I have been researching the life and times of Claire Pally. That's because she was the first, I started with her. But, of course, it set me thinking about who might have been the others, and, in particular, who might have been the first 10. I just chose 10 because it seemed like a convenient number. And people kept on asking me, you know, who's on your list? They keep saying. So I thought I'd share the list with you. So the list, as it is, a bit of a work in progress, because the sources, you know, like all historical sources, they're a bit kind of difficult. But apart from Claire Pally, the next one was Gillian. I knew this. The next one was Gillian White, yes, who was appointed in Manchester. She's an international lawyer, in 1975. And then Rosalind Higgins, here at the LSE. So she was appointed in 1979. Then we jump to 1985, when we get Valentine Cora at UCL, Gabby Gant, Gabrielle Gant,
yes,
at Southampton. Brenda Barrett, here's Exhibit A. So at Middlesex. And then, as she was then, Brenda Hoggett at Manchester in 1986. Tina Lyon at Kiel in 87. Catherine O'Donovan at Kent in 1988. And also in that spectacular year, Exhibit B, Carol Pardo. Okay, so that's the first 10. So I just thought that was kind of pretty amazing that it took us till 1988 to have 10 female law professors. So that's really what started me on the project. But just one thing to kind of remember, when you're thinking about the first one, about Claire Pally, and you know, wasn't it amazing that she was only appointed in 1970, at the time she was appointed, I looked at what the situation was in law schools around the UK. There were 33 law schools then offering law degrees, which provided an LLB, essentially. That, in other words, they were not teaching law as part of an accounting degree or some other degree. So 33 of them offering, essentially, LLBs. So 9 of them, which is 27%, had no women at all at any level. So I can name and shame. Aberdeen, Cambridge, Durham, Hull, Kent, Leicester, Liverpool, Nottingham, Warwick had no women at all. And then there's so many with no promoted women, because 88% of law schools had no promoted women, so I won't bore you with that list. But law schools with promoted women, the good people, are only 4 of them. So obviously Queen's University Belfast with Claire Pally, the LSE with Olive Stone, who was a reader, UCL with Valentine Cora, who was a reader, and Southampton with Gabby Gans, who was a senior lecturer. So in 1970, only 4 promoted women, just before Claire got her chance. So we just thought we would fill you in on that kind of background, and I'm part of Linda's project, and we'll be trying to write something for the Journal of Law and Society about Claire Pally. So I'm not going to tell you very much about her now, because you'll have to read it. But we're going to move on, and we're going to introduce our women law professors first, and then we're going to talk to them. So it's my happy duty to introduce to you Brenda Barrett. So this is Brenda Barrett. And Brenda Barrett was the first woman to be appointed to a polytechnic law school in the country. So she read law at St Hugh's College, Oxford. She read for the bar and did her pupillage with the Honourable Sam Silkin, whilst also training as and subsequently working as a secretary. She then got married and taught shorthand and typing at a secondary modern school for 2 years. And by doing that, was able to gain what was then called qualified teacher status, which came in very handy 40 years later when the Higher Education Academy kind of appeared and she could wave her certificate in front of them and they recognised it. So that was jolly good. So in 1962, she took up a post as an assistant lecturer in the Department of Commerce at Hendon Technical College, supposedly to teach typing, but actually teaching law. She was then instrumental in getting that law programme recognised by the CNAA, the Council for National Awards, I think it was called, when Middlesex Polytechnic was formed. So that was the national body that regulated polytechnic. All polytechnics and all their degrees. So you had to get your course recognised by them, and that was quite an arduous task. Then in the mid-1970s, Brenda did a PhD on the history of employers' liability, and her research has been on health and safety law. She's published extensively in that area, and one of her research projects, you'd like to know this, one of her research projects involved comparing Norwegian and British offshore installations, which allowed her to visit those installations at a time when women were not allowed offshore in the British sector of the North Sea. And you are. I'll ask her about that later. More recently, Brenda has been involved in quality assurance, including initiating collaborative arrangements all over the world, and she's continued this involvement after her quotes retirement. She was appointed to an academic post above reader, that's what they called it in those days, at Middlesex Polytechnic in 1985 as a professor of law. And she's currently Professor Emeritus at Middlesex, working on a project on employment without retirement. So that's Brenda Barrett for you. So hand.
Okay, Carol Harlow is an Emeritus Professor of Law at the LSE. She was made a QC in 1996 and is a Bencher of the Middle Temple, Fellow of the British Academy and a Council Member of the British Academy from 2004 to 2007. She's an Emeritus Member of the Society of Legal Scholars, awarded a Leverhulme Fellowship in 2002 to research the liability of the state, and that was also the subject of her Clarendon Lectures in 2002. She's been a visiting professor all over the place, including the EUI, Duke University, University of New South Wales, University of Auckland. And she's currently expert advisor to the House of Lords Select Committee on Inquiries.
Well, luckily that's finished.
It's finished, yeah. Well, from the story she told me this afternoon, it might not be quite finished yet. I think Carol's been causing trouble. The more important bit, I think, that I wanted to say was to just mention Carol's absolutely groundbreaking work on administrative law with her long-term collaborator, Rick Rawlings from UCL. And I think those of us who are socio-legal scholars will know how that has inspired a whole generation of scholars to get their hands dirty, delve down deep into areas of administrative law that many doctrinal scholars weren't very interested in for a number of years. And I think that's been a really remarkable contribution that she's made to the Academy. Dawn Oliver, on my immediate right, is Emeritus Professor of Constitutional Law at UCL. She was Dean of the Faculty from 1993 to 98, and then again in 2007. Editor of Public Law from 1993 to 2002. Lionel Cohen Lecturer at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Associate Fellow of Newnham College, Cambridge. Member of the Royal Commission on the Reform of the House of Lords. Member of the Fabian Society Commission on the Future of the Monarchy. She's been chair of the UK Constitutional Law Group and a member of the Executive Committee of the International Association of Constitutional Law. She's been a member of the Study of Parliament Group since 1991 and its president since 2010. She was elected a Fellow of the British Academy in 2005 and a Bencher of the Honourable Society of the Middle Temple in 1996. And she was actually the first female treasurer of the Middle Temple in 2011 and made a Queen's Counsel in 2013. So, fantastic lineup, as I'm sure you would have heard.
So, we're going to start off, I think, with our questions. And we've asked one of the women law professors to lead on each question, but the others may chip in if they've got something special to say. So, I'm going to start with you, Brenda, and ask you, if I may, what it was that attracted you about academic life.
Well, you have read out my whole career, really, and you see that I didn't go straight into academic life. In fact, I think I had the lead into what happened when talking this morning to a gentleman now in his mid-50s who finds his employer about to merge with another organisation, and we both knew that the transfer of undertakings regulations would enable him to be re-employed with the person who was taking over his employer. But it was really rather uncertain what sort of job he would get. And he said, well, the first thing that I've learnt, really, the fundamental thing in my life, is that you have to adapt to circumstances. And I think that probably my whole career has been a question of responding to circumstances. I think you mentioned, when you read out my life story, that I took my matric, as it was then called, at a private school due to war circumstances, where the headmistress was cousin of Heath Robinson. You may not all know that Heath Robinson excelled in drawings of peculiar mechanical devices, making it very complicated to, for example, make cups of tea. Well, his cousin had much the same sort of philosophy, that we should resolve problems by the materials available to us at the time. So we weren't so much taught for matric as told to find our own way there. Having got that, it was necessary for me to go to another school. So my mother said, well, shall we just walk round the corner from home to the local co-ed county grammar school? And the headmaster said, start on Monday. What are you going to study? And I said, well, certainly history. My mother said she'd better do economics because her father wants her to be an accountant. So the headmaster said, well, then you better also do geography. Well, the school was, the school was very academic and had an extremely good reputation in getting girls to Oxbridge. In fact, I was taught by people who had been to Oxford and studied and got an appropriate qualification there before the university recognised that women could graduate. So they got me into St. Hugh's. And the question then became, what should you study? And I said, history. And my father said, there is no way I am going to support you in doing a history degree. And he said that looking at my mother, because some of her cousins had left the army at the end of the war to do a quick course that they then did and ended up as primary school teachers. So the headmaster being a lawyer and there being a strong tradition of law, I ended up by doing jurisprudence at Oxford. And really, I don't know if that was very wise, because every first degree there had to be largely philosophical. And I never did really get much beyond Austin. Unsurprisingly, my only final paper, which had a touch of alpha, was in English legal history. When I came down, I had no idea really what career I wanted. And the Oxford careers advisor said, well, you clearly are not an academic, so I think you should do something practical like personnel management. However, this coincided with my 21st birthday, so I persuaded my parents to pay for me to do a postgraduate secretarial course and supported myself through reading dinners and taking bar finals by being a secretary. But then I unwisely got married during pupillage. And I found that I needed to earn some more money to support the mortgage. So I went back to being a school secretary. But unknown to me, the headmistress phoned up my old headmaster and asked him for a reference. And he phoned me up and he said, what on earth are you doing? I'll get you a job in teaching. So I went to the local secondary modern school to teach shorthand typing and some commerce and some English to year seven, as we now call it. This was a two-year post because the proper incumbents had gone to Garnet to get a teaching qualification. So as you've been told, I came out of that 2 years as a qualified teacher in the eyes at least of Middlesex County Council. And I applied to the local Hendon College of Technology to teach shorthand tag, and I ended up, that was appointments in May, and in September, when I first took up the appointment, I was given law to teach. So
that's how you ended up in law.
Well, you asked me how I took up an academic career. I've told you how I got into teaching, but whether that was academic, I wouldn't like to say.
So, Carol, tell us your story of how you became an academic.
Oh, I thought you were going to ask me how many women were around in those days.
Well,
and
we've
just actually been changing notes on it, because I just turned it around a little bit. And we discovered that there were about 5 women in the year when each of us started studying. So, essentially, you know, that is a very small proportion. I think there were about 100 students in the first year law degree at King's, of whom 5 were women, and I think I'm right that 10 years later I was the only one who was actually working as a lawyer. Mm-hmm. So then there were sort of a number of devious things that I'll go back on, but when I came to the LSE there was Olive Stone and Jennifer Temkin already in the law department, and I think the law department would have had about 30 members of staff in it in those days. And I'm glad you mentioned Olive earlier, because actually I feel very strongly indeed about Olive. I cannot understand that, you know, that she had never got a chair. It was an absolute scandal.
Yes.
She was a very fine scholar, and it was simply prejudice.
Many people have said that. Yes.
So, I mean, I think that's the answer to the question I thought you were going to ask. But the question you actually did ask about how I got into law was by mistake, because I actually refused to learn typing, which I now bitterly regret. So I know that I would have been made into a secretary, and I didn't want to be a secretary. I wanted to be a theatre designer. But my father, who had he was actually a historian, and he did his work on legal history, the Selden Society, and all that sort of thing. And his brother was a solicitor, so it was determined that I had to be a lawyer because I wouldn't be able to earn my living at law. So that is the real... I got into academic life by mistake, because I'd been working in Africa and I'd done quite a lot of poor people's defences and so on and so forth. When I came back, I actually wanted to go to the bar, but by mistake I'd gone and contracted hepatitis, and I wasn't fit enough to go to the bar, so I ended up in the Polytechnic. Well, first in the Inter Court School of Law, because Charles Morrison, who started it, thought that it would be nice to have someone who'd been in Africa, because there were a lot of African students. So, happenstance.
So, going to move on slightly, and Dawn, we tend to be very focused on research these days in many universities, and we were wondering if you could give us an indication of what the kind of workload was like when you became a law professor.
Ah, when I became a law professor.
Or even when you became an academic.
When I joined, yes, yeah. When I joined UCL, which I did in 1976. Well, then... really, all our work was very, very focused on teaching. And although when I was taken on and when we were all taken on, there was sort of understanding that you would do research, there wasn't really much of an understanding about what scholarly research was, and you sort of had to be writing and publishing stuff, but which, I mean, I was happy to do, and I mean, thrilled to do. But really, we spent most of our time doing things to do with the students. So the teaching load was about 10 to 12 hours a week, I think. Quite small classes. lots of essays to mark, though, you know, many more essays. The students got, I think, 3 hours of lectures a week in each subject rather than 2, which is what people tend to get now. We had no secretarial or administrative assistance, so we had to... there were rather peculiar copying machines, Gestetners. So you would type, and we none of us knew how to type, really, so you would type up your handouts, and then you would go down and do this thing with this machine, and so the students were not getting many handouts, but the ones they got, we did, and there were no photocopiers either. And then, so a lot of time, doing the teaching, then we... At UCL, we interviewed all the students who were applying for places to read the LLB. And that was very time-consuming. Every Wednesday afternoon in term time, most of us were interviewing lots and lots of students. And there was no sort of administrative support either, virtually no. So it was all to do with that. I mean, one of my colleagues used to move the furniture around from room to room, if the furniture needed reading, that would be an academic who'd be doing that. So research was really what we, I think, loved doing. But, I mean, there wasn't much time for this, and there wasn't much mentoring or support for it. That's, I'm talking about 1976. Then when the RAE started, which was in the mid-80s, I think, then obviously the pressure was on to produce research, and that meant wondering, what is research? I mean, is it just making sure you're up to date with your lectures, or is it something else? And that was how it was. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That sounds really different from LSE, where I come from a polytechnic, where we believed in teaching, and I was absolutely horrified at the LSE's teaching standards, that you can actually dignify them with that name. It really wasn't until... all those things leading up to the RAE and teaching assessments came in, that we put our house into order, and I'm glad things are not the same today. And they didn't also... Did you ever hear the word research? Because at the LSE it was writing.
I think it was called writing. Or publishing.
Yes.
I think that at Middlesex, or at Hendon as it then was, we were much better off for administrative support in producing materials, certainly, than they are now. Most of the academics, if I can use that word, were quite adamant that they weren't employed to type. So they were not going to produce lecture material.
Well, I mean, with us, there was what we call secretarial support for professors, but until you were a professor, it was DIY.
Yeah, that's right. I can remember that when I started as an academic. Yeah.
So, Brenda, can I ask you when it was that you first thought that being a professor was within your reach? Was it a conscious decision that this was something that you wanted to try for, or was it a case of accidental happenings? There seems to be a little bit of a pattern that's emerging.
Yes, yes. When I was first appointed to... Well, I was appointed to Hendon Technical College, but by the time I took up the post, it had changed its status to become Hendon College of Technology, which was rather posher. I hadn't been there very long before the head of department proposed that I work for a PhD part-time, and they did support me in doing that at UCL. And that was an interesting experience, because when I went for interview for that, I was ushered into a very formal setting, and they said, "What is your shorthand typing like?" And I said, "Well, I haven't sort of done it for a bit, like, not to know what my speeds are." And they said, "But you've applied for this post to be secretary to the head of department." And I told them, "No, I haven't," so we sorted that out. I got my PhD in 1974, and the head of department at what was then the Intersex Business School, dragged me off to the health and safety executive, and we came away with a research project, which wasn't really what you might call a research project. It was writing up the situation in the United Kingdom to be presented to the EC, as it then was, who were getting such a history from each of the member states. But having completed that, they asked me to do this offshore installation work, which was perhaps the most adventurous part of my career. And maybe I wouldn't have got on to offshore installations and the like if I hadn't chosen a male colleague to be a partner in this research. And they had to get me off before nightfall, which was a bit hair-raising, because it takes 3 hours to do the round journey to the installation that I was visiting. And the wind was such that it took us 2 hours to get back. And I just shut my eyes. And when we got there, my colleague said, "They thought you were going to freak out." I said, "Wasn't that? I thought I was going to be sick." It wouldn't have been very appropriate to be sick in the community of offshore oil men. Well, I jogged on and by devious means got the law degree, and I led the law degree. And then at some point, a post of reader was advertised internally. And I applied for it and didn't get it. And the person that did get it, I had very low opinion of, and made me gratified, actually, because he came very badly unstuck somewhat later. And so I chucked my research at the head of department and said, "If I am not fit to have a post as a researcher, then you better find somebody else to do my research." Very shortly after that, there was an internal appointment for professor, and the head of department came to me and said, "Can you give me your CV, because I want to propose you for a professorship?" And that's how I got it. Oh.
So, when you were thinking about becoming a professor, if you did, Carol, who did you look to for support in actually achieving that?
Well, I had a good laugh when I saw that question. I mean, support wasn't a word that would have even understood, I don't think. And I can't say that I was thinking of being a professor. I was simply applying for jobs, not particularly at the LSE. Because I needed a job and not getting them. So support, I don't know. I think I had an idea that women might succeed when I was very fortunate to gain a 2-month bursary to the French Conseil d'Etat. And there were some really outstanding women there. They were just terrific, and I've never seen anything like that or met anyone who'd really done that. And I suppose that actually gave me an idea that I needn't not apply for a chair because I was a female. Mm.
Yes, that's very interesting.
So Dawn, tell us what you think you needed to do to actually get your chair. I mean, we often say about women that they have to do a little bit more than men. Did you have that sense that you needed to overcompensate for your sex, or...?
I don't think it was plain sailing, really. But frankly, I've never had a proper career plan. So, you know, I was promoted to a reader, which was nice, but I hadn't sort of planned it much in ahead, I think in 1990. And then I began to think, well, you know, maybe in due course a chair. And then I published my first book in about 1992. And I didn't really think it was worth a chair, but I did say to the head of department, and I must say the dean and head of departments were very supportive. I was lucky. Well, then what happened was that our dean and head of department was elected the master of Clare College, Cambridge, and they were looking around for somebody who might be the next dean and head of department. And frankly, really, my male colleagues would simply have either refused or not done it well, I think. So it was put to me rather informally, well, would I do it? And I said, well, you know, if I take that on, I'm never going to get a chair because it'll just not give me the time. So I think what I had to do was agree to be dean and head of department and have a bit of a publishing record, and that's, I think, how I got it.
And when you became a professor, Brenda, what was the reaction to you becoming a professor?
Nil.
Zero.
In the traditional university world, it wasn't really regarded as a serious post, I think. Within my own institution, I was not the first female professor to be appointed. This introduction of the academic post above reader, as it was then called, was a novelty within the polytechnics, and so there were not very many professors, as we came to be called, within my polytechnic at that time, but I was not the first female one. So really, I don't think anybody particularly noticed.
Was that the same for you, Carol? Was it a kind of nobody said anything type?
I don't know how many. I think a figure of nine goes in my head for LSE professors. But the LSE was profoundly elitist, and so if you were a professor at the LSE, you were a professor at the LSE. I do remember one terribly funny thing, being put on a committee, and an elderly member of the committee kept on calling me Mrs. Harlow, and Rodney Barker, my nice colleague, said, you know, why are you doing this? And he said, I thought she would think it was nicer. That's the only thing I really remember about.
So, I mean, I think it's very clear that we all think of all three of you as trailblazers, and I know you sort of poo-pooed this idea, Dawn, because that is the way that you were looking at yourself. But did you have any sense of breaking that ground in that way?
No.
Never thought about it.
Amazing.
Well, I think times were entirely different. I mean, and actually when I got married and went to Africa, my husband went on in advance, and the Foreign Office wouldn't let me buy a ticket without his permission. So when you come from that sort of, well, they soon did buy a ticket without his permission, but that's the sort of thing I did make trouble about. But like, when you come from that background, I don't think you think of yourself like that. You just get on with life.
And I think UCL was and still is a liberal place. So there
yes.
was, I mean, Val Cora was already a professor in the law department.
Yes.
And I don't think anyone thought, how extraordinary that there should be a female law professor.
No.
I mean, it was just. And I certainly didn't think of myself as being extraordinary because I was female. And I had practiced at the bar, actually. Academic life was my second career. And I practiced at the bar, and there were hardly any of us. And we're just, you know, you were one of the boys, really. I didn't take any notice of that.
And did you make connections at all with other female law professors?
Well, Carol and I were talking
yes.
about this because it so happened that there were five female heads of department around London at the time, and that was Carol, then Hazel Genn, who was then head of department at Queen Mary, Gillian Morris, who was head of department at Brunel, and Jennifer Temkin, who was head of department in Sussex and lived in London. So we got together and we used to have lunch together once or twice a year. And it was partly to sort of commiserate about it. But it was good to have the female, you know, support, really, because it's quite stressful being head of department, and I think probably particularly for women, because your colleagues feel more able to make demands of you, I think, if you're a woman.
And did you feel that becoming a professor sort of imposed obligations on you to look after women that were coming up after you?
Asking me. No, I don't think I did. I thought I had responsibilities to the group with, that I was concerned with, but not particularly responsibilities to women. There were a number of occasions when I felt that somebody wasn't getting a fair deal. I mean, for example, there was, I don't think I've mentioned that for a lot of the time I was a program leader for the law degree, and so that gave me responsibilities for the team. And at that stage, someone was likely to be dismissed, and I was told that I needn't really take any formal part in considering his case until the last minute. I was asked, will you support us dismissing him? And I said, not until I have been allowed to interview him and hear his side of the story. In fact, as so often happens in these circumstances, he didn't come to see me. He became very ill from the strain of knowing what was being built up for him. Then at one point I edited a business law book, and I took considerable care to get a chapter out of two of the women who had no publishing experience. There was another time in the days when senior management was taken off to stay at a hotel for staff development and strategy of the university and so on. And the personnel manager at that time felt that there was a lot of sex discrimination, so she planned that after dinner, when the coffee was served, all the women would get up and walk out. And I got up and I walked out, and I said to this group, you silly fools, you've just done the female thing of withdrawing to the drawing room. And I marched back in to join the men. I don't think that being a professor made any great difference to the sort of way in which I had been behaving in respect of my colleagues, male or female, up to that point.
Yeah. And thinking back over this time, Carol, how do you think things have changed for women in law schools?
Well, I think they've changed beyond belief. To start with, they're about 50% now of many law schools, and that makes a huge difference. I mean, just that alone is an enormous change. In some ways, they've got harder, because I think probably when we started, the hours and things and the pressure was less, and it was much easier to manage a family. And now I think it would be much harder, and there's just more pressure generally about. I don't think I've pondered over this one. I don't know, it all feels a lot nicer now. But
nicer? Yes. Despite the pressure?
Despite the pressure, the equality side of it seems, you know, hugely nicer. I mean, I can really remember walking into the senior common room and not knowing where to sit. you know, and things like that. And that just makes a tremendous difference.
I mean, I think the other thing that has got easier than, for example, when my children were young in the early 70s, late 60s, in those days there was virtually no organised childcare. I mean, you had to pay someone either to come into your house. There might be childminders, but nothing flexible. There were no nurseries at all. So now, not just for, obviously, for academic women, but for professional women at all, there is much greater, I know it's expensive, but at least there is childcare there, and flexible and long hours childcare available. But it just didn't exist when my children were young. And so one of the attractions of an academic moving into academia was flexible hours. Although I don't think I ever did miss a, you know, miss a lecture because of my family, but, I mean, you can't miss a trial. Because you've got a sick child, and there's that flexibility.
I find it's much harder for my daughter, much harder, all the child care things,
really?
Actually.
Is that expense,
yes,
or,
well,
availability?
It's. I mean, I do remember that when I came to the LSE first, the whole of my... No, I think that was actually before that, but for 4 years my salary just paid the childcare. And but now,
yeah, well, it's
without a granny they wouldn't survive. Because it's just ruinously expensive.
I agree, it is expensive.
And also makes you feel quite guilty all the time.
Yeah.
But I do think that there's equality and the expectation that women work, that just sort of makes huge difference.
I was incredibly lucky. When I became pregnant, or before that even, I had met a neighbour across the road, and she said, you're so clever, I've never done anything except been a housewife and brought up my two sons. When I became pregnant, I said, Joyce, would you be babyminder to my daughter? And she said, well, I would, but I can't do it for more than about 6 months, because, you see, I hurt my back some time ago and I couldn't manage a larger child. And I thought, well, what about her two sons? Well, the whole family virtually adopted my daughter. If I had to go away for an offshore installations and things, she stayed there and the dog went too. And really that was another thing that kept me at Hendon, that she was so fortunate that she had this wonderful support, and so was I.
Is Joyce still available?
Joyce remained on the scene until she died in her 80s, and I had kept close contact with her husband until he died just before Christmas at the age of 97.
Well, I think we've said enough. So the idea is now to throw it open to you so that you can ask questions, pose more difficult questions to Carol. Yeah, thank you.
I think there's an issue for Fiona about the definition of a professor and promotion. Olive Stone has mentioned. I think some of the top universities were very mean,
yes,
about the number of
absolutely
chairs for a start, and you might have got one more easily in another university, but also they didn't promote. Olive Stone is an outstanding example. Anywhere else of today, she would have been a professor. And Brenda, I don't know who taught you. Did Ivy Williams teach you? No?
No.
I don't know who taught you at St. Hugh's, but certainly there was someone in Oxford called Ivy Williams.
Yes.
And again, she would have been a professor, except I guess she was overlooked. And certainly in my time, there were several women in Oxford, I'm not thinking of myself, who in another setting would have been professors.
Yeah.
And the women had twice as much of a teaching load as the men, because there were fewer women's colleges. The advantage was there was a nursery from day one. And research, I think the big difference is research. You could only, well, as a mother, you could only get research done at the weekend. The library was closed at the weekend, and there was no internet. So, you know, you were really stuck if you couldn't get the library. That was it. I think there were obstacles in the way of women, too few chairs, and they didn't get promoted, especially in family law. It was looked down on. I think that was the problem with Oliver. So,
yes.
Quite some resentment.
I remember qualifying for the bar roof and everybody doing chamber interviews and people saying, of course you'll be a family lawyer. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was definitely a Cinderella subject.
Yeah, because when I started teaching Johnny class, I said, of course you'll do family
law. Yes.
And it's just as well, because I loved it, but you know, it hadn't occurred to
me. Mm. That's right.
Nikki, could you say who you are for the purposes of the table?
I'm Nikki Lacey and I'm here at LSE. And I was a student at UCL and arrived exactly the same year as Dawn, although I never had the good fortune to be taught by you. But I got through my whole 5 years of legal training, the LLB at UCL and then the BCL for 2 years in Oxford, without once being taught by a woman. And it didn't honestly ever occur to me to think about that until relatively late on. And I think it was really when I went back to UCL as a teacher and I started facing the questions from my female students about the legal profession and their own career development. And I started to really think about it. And then when I went back to work in Oxford and worked with Ruth, and still then just a handful of other women in the faculty. It was just one other woman in an ex-men's college, Mary Stokes, that I became increasingly concerned with it. But the question for you would be, I mean, today, if a law school had no women or one or two women, it would feel completely illegitimate. When do you think, all of you, that moment started to happen?
Well, I was thinking up that last night, and I remember very clearly that it was when the Big Bang happened in the city, and suddenly you couldn't get any commercial lawyers. Mm. And it made an opportunity in two ways. A lot of extremely talented women thought, well, teaching isn't quite so pressurised as going into a city solicitor's firm. Plus, you had the double salary, of which one was the city solicitor's salary. And that brought an awful lot of women into academic life and changed things radically. For the better.
Now, I actually was taught as part of the time at Oxford by a woman.
That's good.
Hazel Stewart, as she was then called, who was Lord Denning's stepdaughter.
Hazel Fox.
And is now.
Hazel
yes.
Fox.
Yes.
Mm. I mean, I can't myself sort of put a year on when we started having more, engaging more women. But what was remarkable, that certainly in the sort of the late 70s, early 80s, we did appoint women, but they tended to move on. So one followed her husband to Canada, well, that happens. Another one, I think, wasn't enjoying teaching, so she went into practice. Another one went off to, she came from the north of England, she went back there. I mean, they were moving more than the men were. That was my thought. They'd come to us for 2 or 3 years and then move on, either to another university or just off. And the men tended to stay. And actually, when I joined UCL, almost all of the members of the faculty were UCL graduates.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Lizzie Barnes, and taught by Dawn. Not taught by Dawn, being a colleague of Dawn's, although it felt like being taught by
Dawn.
I'm no doubt reading between the lines, but it sounded in what each of you said, like there was at least with Brenda and Dawn, a bit of a theme of having had some senior colleagues who were kind of encouraging or pushing you, or they, even if you didn't have a clear career plan, who had a bit of a plan for you. And I just wondered if you might say a bit more about that, and whether what you think of that kind of, if that's right, that there's a kind of patronage going on, whether you've got any wider thoughts about how that might have worked, and maybe sometimes, yeah, to include some and exclude others.
I mean, I think we had for some years, one dean and head of department, then another one. As it happened, they were both very keen, I think, on equal opportunities and very open. I do know that actually when I was appointed, the dean and head of the department put me on a lower salary than everybody else. I mean, I didn't realise, no one ever talked about how much they were earning. But when the new dean arrived and was reviewing salaries, he told me that I'd been put on a lower one, so he put me up. Of course, I mean, that would be entirely... But certainly that one and the next one were very supportive. But, I mean, of course, for the first one, the one who put my salary up, was supportive because I was a woman who'd been discriminated against, and I appreciated that. But I think generally they were both looking to do the best by all their staff, and that included me. But,
No, I don't think that I particularly benefited. I think I did say that when I had my PhD on employers' liability, the head of department dragged me off to the health and safety executive, but that was much in his interest, as it wasn't really to promote me, I think. I don't think really that there's any stage that I benefited from people within my own institution. Colleague with whom I wrote a lot was only temporarily at Middlesex, and initially when I started publishing he was quite helpful, and a lot of the things that I did publish thereafter were jointly with him, but I don't think it was patronage really.
Maybe attachment is the wrong word, maybe mentoring is another word, but just wondering about those cross-generational relationships, whether that felt important.
When did mentoring start?
Yeah, I should think. This was.
Yep. Has it started?
Ross Cranston. Can I ask about your remark, Dawn, that as the head of department, you were treated differently. The demands were greater on you. And maybe Carol can say something about that, because she was head of department when I came to the LSE.
Yeah.
And as a consumer, she certainly treated me differently through the whole appointment process than I knew I would have been treated by a man.
Oh.
But she was extremely considerate and extremely kind, and kept me informed, and basically helped me the job.
So the question is...
So you said when you met all the
yes.
these heads of school together, the five
yes,
of
yes,
you,
we were,
you
said, yes.
you just said in passing,
yes.
I think we found it all quite helpful because...
Yes.
We felt it was a bit more difficult for a woman
yes.
being head of school.
Well, I think, I've only been the head of the department there, so one doesn't know what it's like in other places. But certainly my experience. Well, actually, I made a great mistake. Not that I think the word was put around, but when a colleague of mine, a female colleague, said, are you taking this on? I said, for goodness sake, I brought up three children. I can surely look after, And my problem was, I did think of them, not as children in the sense of being infantile, but in the sense that you want to do what you can for people. So people would come and make unreasonable demands, and I would sort of feel I had to do my best for them. And it was, as it so happened, it was the men who were making demands. And I had a few female colleagues, and they were really no trouble. I was probably just lucky, it was probably a lucky time. But Carol, what was your...
I certainly think that I did get treated differently. I was the first woman head of department, and there wasn't therefore any sort of prototype to go on. And again, women colleagues were immensely supportive because, you know, they certainly didn't want me to be a bad failure. So I had to scramble through it somehow. But I know that we all felt that, I have the feeling that we actually met once a term.
Maybe it was.
And that we did feel that it was quite good to have that sort of support, because we were all the first, really. And so we sort of wanted to know how it was done.
Well, I'm with Ross here because you won't remember, Dawn, but you once wrote me the nicest rejection letter I've ever had. it was charming. It made me want to apply again, which is quite a special thing to do.
Yeah, I'm Bernard Keane, a PhD student here and graduate of Queen's, so I suppose I have some sort of reflected glory or something. But I wanted to ask about the, the actual content of legal education and when sort of feminism or feminist critical theory began to enter into that. And was that something that you were conscious of, you know, when teaching law or when designing courses? Or, you know, to what extent did you feel that was something that you had to play a part in, or were you, did anyone try and list you, you know? And I'm just wondering whether any controversies or how that sort of the content of legal education began to change during your career. So that's for everyone or anyone.
Well, the one about feminism, you'll have to ask Nikki. She's sitting just in front of you, so she can turn around and answer it. But certainly the content of legal education has changed greatly, and it's become much more specialist. But at the same time, it's also has more choice in it. So from that point of view. Can I turn around also and answer Ross's question a bit better? I think the worst thing that ever happened to me was that I was the first woman vice chair of the LSE Promotions Committee. And the women in the school expected a lot of me, and I was the first one to lose a sex discrimination case, and that was quite horrible. I still wake up actually thinking about that.
Nikki, did you want to add anything?
Oh, it feels like I've been sort of thrust into it unjustly.
Sorry, Nikki. No, sorry.
I suppose. For me, so actually that time, so I, Mary Stokes and I wasn't part of any course, but then it sort of infiltrated into the jurisprudence course, a course on feminist legal theory in Oxford from 1985, I think. But by then, Erica Szeszczak and Jenny Temkin were already teaching here. Vicky Fisher in Southampton, Sue Atkins, Brenda in
Manchester.
Yeah, that's right. And so, and there was a women law teachers network in London of people, and for me that was just tremendously important in the early part of my career, that and my network of female colleagues in Oxford and through that women law teachers network. But it also did have, it made me think, the experience of being a very rare woman still then teaching in law did make me think about law from a feminist point of view. It was a politicising thing that stayed with me quite a long time. And many, many people around in this room have made huge contributions in that area.
I just wanted to know if you had any thoughts about whether, because sometimes I feel like getting women in the position isn't enough and you need more of a kind of larger change, and whether you had any thoughts about how that might occur. Not that that's the case for you, I think, people would be doing anything. But like, I went to a talk here about rape in last terms, And actually, the three women won that, and the man was the most vocally progressive for the stuff. And the two women were pretty old school in their views, and just that, the fact that having women there isn't always quite enough.
Drive that on the treasury job.
Yeah. I don't think I've really quite understood. Are you wondering whether women, let's say women academics or women generally, need a bit of assertiveness training or need to be more sort of woken up to what's going on around them? I'm sorry, I'm probably being rather thick, but no, I'm not getting the point.
Just the fact that having women in a certain position doesn't mean that the wider structure will change. Mm. And that change needs to address both men and women, and not might not necessarily come from them, but probably,
Yes.
I think structures change quite gradually, but on the particular academic thing, Jenny Temkin did all her research and so forth and was a leader in studies about rape. So, I mean, you could say you were 30 years too late in that particular seminar, and I myself have very old-fashioned views academically. So, you know, I think you can't really generalise about it. But believe you me, if when you get to be my age and look back, you'll see that the structures have changed.
I think, can I just answer that, because I'm quite interested in it. And I think one of the things that is promoting change at the moment in universities is a requirement by research councils, which is kind of coming down the hill, that universities have to have what they call an Athena Swan kind of badging. An Athena Swan is about the number of women who are academics and promoted as academics and showing that you have a very active kind of equality and diversity policy and da 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 da. And Athena Swan has been going for quite a long time in science. It's being run out now to humanities and social science. And for a long time, anybody had anything to do with Athena Swan, it was, you know, we were like bizarre women in a corner doing something with Athena Swan. But as soon as it starts to be related to money and grants and research grants that universities are really, really keen on, then suddenly there's lots of interest in it and a lot of more people are a lot more serious about it. So actually I think it's kind of money in that sense is going to talk. And I think that will bring about structural change. So I think that could be one of the answers to your question, not the only one.
Yeah, thank you very much. My name is Anne Salve and I'm a PhD student here. I've heard quite a lot of questions about what kind of support you've received from the academic community and from colleagues. And when you started talking about how you got into study law or how you got into an academic career, I heard my father said this and my mother said this, and I was wondering how important the support that you got from parents, husbands, or family more broadly, how important that was in achieving what you have in your career.
My father expected me to achieve. Full stop.
Well, this might be quite different from what other fathers might expect their daughters to achieve. So,
you see, the family was very disappointed I wasn't a boy. And the best thing that my grandfather could ever say was, "You're a good boy, aren't you?"
Well, I got a good education because my Austrian grandfather educated his three daughters. So they, you know, would take the thing down. My father thought it was a waste of money for me to go to university and that I would get married and that would be the end of working. And he therefore didn't allow me to apply to Cambridge because I could get a free education at King's London. So that's that. Well, my husband never suggested I shouldn't work, but some of the things that he did made it very difficult, and some of the things that I did made it equally difficult for him.
Yes, I think I had a lot of encouragement from my family. I must say, at school, I was at a girl and only, you know, girls only school, and not most schools were single sex in those days. But one of our very influential teachers said, "You've got to be three times as good as a man if you're going to succeed in things that men do." I don't think that made me work that much harder, but it was quite a salutary thought. And my father, I think, was very keen. And my mother. My father was a lawyer, and I wanted to be a barrister. He was a solicitor, and I wanted to be a barrister, and I think he was rather chuffed about that, because barristers meant to be better. And so on. And then I was very lucky that when I had a family, my husband was very supportive. And in fact, you know, the flexible hours in academia are useful, so I would take Wednesdays off. That meant I missed faculty meetings to get the children from school and so on, and my husband took Friday afternoons off to deal with the children. And so, I mean, that sort of thing is very helpful, actually. So I was lucky.
But one generation you haven't asked about, of course, is the children. And I was very fortunate that my children were both extremely healthy. But also, they were absolutely supportive, and they were incredibly proud. And they, you know, they've been absolute bricks all the way through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good too.
Hello, I'm Leila, and I'm actually in sixth form at the moment, a bit younger. But just going back to the structural point, I wondered, you having lived through this change, what you think, especially having worked in Parliament before, about all women shortlists and positive discrimination towards women, and just your views on that right there.
Well, in academia, for example, or generally?
Right.
Well, I don't think all women, I don't think that sort of thing would go down very well in academia, actually. I mean, there is, well, I haven't seen the statistics, but I think there is reasonably good representation of women now in most law faculties. So I don't think that's a problem. I mean, there are all sorts of problems if women have children who are unwell and can't put as much time into research and so on as maybe men can. I'm not saying there aren't any problems, but I wouldn't myself say that it's bad enough to go in for that sort of positive discrimination.
I just wondered, a really factual question for Fiona, is whether your research embraces comparative statistics for other disciplines.
Not yet.
Is law the worst offender? And so why?
No, it's not.
Science
has much earlier women's presses.
Yes,
but
yeah. It also has much later women's presses. I mean, the first woman professor of cardiac surgery, for instance, was only appointed in 2003, although there are lots of them. So there are still firsts happening, but most of those are in science or medicine.
And at the LSE, it's economics. I mean, things might have changed, I don't know, but I mean, it was absolutely scandalous at the time when I was on the promotions committee.
So, I don't think that law is the worst offender.
It is a bad offender. I just wonder what characteristics of law, is it just simply because it's the due profession, say, male dominated law, or what?
Well, in terms of when the first was appointed, the first woman to be appointed a professor of any sort, I think, was Caroline Hildred at UCL, who was professor of English in 1913. Although there is a bit of argy-bargy about that, because there was a woman in Wales who might have been first, but there seems to be some ambiguity as to whether she was technically a professor or not. So, I mean, English did it first, so the arts were better at appointing women. And so law comes somewhere in the middle, really, between 1913 and now. 1970 is a match in the middle, so it seems to have steered that middle course. So I think it's done better. For instance, it's done better than engineering, which had its first woman professor much later. And it's done better than many other vocational, what you would think of as masculine type vocational subjects. but it's not as good as.
Alison.
Thank you, all of you, really, for this. This has been really wonderful and enlightening. I have two questions. They're not related, but one is about the... Alison did a QCR. One is about what you were saying, Dawn, about the kind of general gender equality that exists now in the legal academy. And I don't know the answer, and I don't know if anyone knows the statistics, but I wonder if it kind of reflects the same kinds of reality of the legal profession, where there's lots, perhaps 50% women at the kind of lower levels, but very few at the top. There are fewer women law professors than there are at the same sort of proportion as there are senior partners in law firm and QCs. And so I wonder if that's more the issue. So entry level might be fine, but there still might be an issue about promotions. I don't know the statistics.
Yeah. Well, I don't know
that's
the statistics.
Kind of my intuition.
Yeah. Sorry, I mustn't interrupt because you had another question.
Okay. My question was, did you notice, any of the three of you, that how the students reacted to you? Was there any kind of a difference in the way that they interacted with you compared to, hard to say compared to your male colleagues, but
I posed a most tremendous problem for young women from Singapore and Hong Kong and related countries, of whom we have a lot of extremely nice students whom I visit from time to time in their judgeships and so forth. But they really found it intimidating to be taught by a woman who had a deep voice and relentless questions. It wasn't right, and they moved. They actually moved into tutorial groups taught by men.
I
don't think that would happen today, though.
I learned that they were scared of me. There was one rather amusing occasion when these two chaps came to my office and said, we're very worried, we think we made a mess of this exam. I said, I'm sure it's all right, you really shouldn't worry. Anyway, they went, and I realised that one of them had left his pen behind. So I ran down the corridor to give it to him, and he said, did you hear what we were just saying? I said, no. We were just saying the old bat's not so bad when you get to know her.
But your first question, Alison, about non-promotion of women as they get more senior, I mean, up to the top echelons. I don't know the statistics actually at all, but I do think that there are more acute problems probably for women legal practitioners than there are in academia. I mean, it's very, very pressured, I think, successful practice at the bar and in the top solicitors' firms. And so I can sort of... And there's a big fallout still at the bar, I know. But I think that's not... I don't think the pressures are quite the same in academia, really, but, I mean, I don't know.
And I should tell you that Dawn was instrumental in setting up the Middle Temple Women's Forum.
Which is about trying to encourage women to stay on in practice. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not a question, it's just in response to Alison's question. We had a very interesting session last year at our away day, didn't we, from... a lecturer in geography at King's. I can't remember her name, maybe. I don't know if anyone else can.
Kate McLean.
And she presented statistics on women professors, women lecturers, and so on. It was very shocking. I mean, it was absolutely, as you were suggesting, that it's very much bottom heavy, and it's still very uneven, more than I expected, because you sort of look around and you see prominent women, and actually when the statistics were put in front of
they're all in this room right now.
Probably not quite as stark as in the legal profession, but still, you know, nothing like.
Well, do you, Helen, have any, or does anyone have any suggestions why this is the case? I mean, is it discrimination, or is it the women with domestic responsibilities can't put that much time into research? Or, I mean, what do you... Well, I don't want to target you, Helen, but... You know.
I think it's partly behaviour as well. So one of the things at King's, one of the things about that research and more generally is that where you have systems of self-nomination to apply for a chair, the men do tend to go forward better. So promotion panels, I think the statistics show, when the men go for a chair, they get higher points. The women get higher points, which means the men are able to kind of, say for example, get a 4 and get the chair. The women consistently are getting 5s, which means they're probably waiting a couple more years longer than they need to before they go for a chair, because it's self-nomination and confidence before you go in for a chair.
Yeah,
so just on the... sorry.
I was just going to say, it's really, really interesting, because we don't have self-nomination at LSE, and
right.
It's half and half for women professors.
Oh,
and
so
it's absolutely even, there's no...
I think there's a sense in which self-nomination works, has a gender impact as well. But the other thing I wanted to say, I'd be interested to hear what Nikki says about it. We had, is it Sienna Schifrin?
Shauna Schifrin
was talking at King's last semester, and she was saying to me afterwards that certain disciplines in American law schools are much more macho than others.
Yes.
So for her, as a philosopher and doing legal theory and going to a lot of conferences in the US, she said, you know, she had to write a letter to one of the conferences to her male colleagues to say, could you please tone down the kind of macho discourse? So I think some, and I've heard some of my friends who do private law, academic friends, say some of the atmosphere and some of the disciplines in law is much less conducive to kind of women feeling comfortable in that area of research than others. I don't know how if you've had similar experiences.
I think that's right, and I think, for example, I can, exactly as someone who occasionally goes to analytical jurisprudence conferences in America, I know right where Shauna's coming from. And conversely, going back to the point Ruth was making earlier, Ruth Deitch, I think, it's always been the case that family law has been gendered female, you know, with both positive and negative effects for the field. And I completely agree with the point that you made, Ruth. So I think that's absolutely right. That these, but the interesting question then is there, as there certainly was with family law, a sort of intellectual hierarchy that goes with that gendering, and that's the really worrying thing.
Yes. I think now that it's got, that it's actually worse in respect of studies of involving new forms of study into ethnic problems, which I've had some fights about at the British Academy, because they tend to be treated as non-subjects, and then the person doesn't get promotion because they're not studying something that counts.
I'm not going to stop the conversation, but I am going to suggest that we just move outside so you can have a glass of wine while you continue this conversation. But can I ask you to join me in the usual way of thanking our